CFO Radio is the only radio show that explores the passion of today's CFO and examines the innermost thoughts of the financial world, financial perspectives of tomorrow. Welcome to CFO Radio. I'm Lorraine Chilvers.
And we'd like to thank our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, LLC, providing financial leadership to fast-growing companies, interim management and executive placement for the finance function. Visit DelaneyLLC.com and learn why 100% of their clients describe Delaney's services as outstanding and excellent. Also, Financial Executives International, the preeminent association for CFOs and other financial executives. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter.
And this week's CFO Radio News is brought to us by CFO.com. FASB chair answers push for private GAAP. Prompted by a proposal earlier this year by a panel of the Future of Private Company Accounting Standards, a proposal that includes giving oversight of those standards to a brand new board, the Financial Accounting Standards Board has heightened its focus on private company issues, according to Leslie Seedman, the board's chairman. At the Zicklin Center Financial Reporting Conference in New York, Seedman responded to the challenge for the panel, declaring that she hopes the responsibility for private company finance reporting remains squarely in FASB's hands. She noted that the decision about how to respond to the panel's proposal is being deliberated by the Financial Accounting Foundation, FAF. This is FASB's parent organization. In January, the panel recommended that the FAF create a separate accounting standards board with the ultimate standard-setting authority to determine and set exceptions and modifications in GAAP for private companies. Rather than proposing the creation of a separate version of GAAP for private companies, however, the panel recommended that accounting standards for non-public companies be based on existing U.S. GAAP, but with exceptions and modifications that would result in financial statements providing relevant, decision-useful information that meets the needs of the users of private company financial statements in a cost-effective manner. And that's a quote. Seedman acknowledged that hearing concerns about the relevance of GAAP to private companies and complaints that current accounting standards are overly complex for private company stakeholders, the FASB chair said she strongly supports the panel's short-term recommendations related to the process changes, including considering a delay for private companies of the effective date of major new standards. In fact, Seedman noted that FASB has implemented or is in the process of implementing practically all of the short-term recommendations. In developing the framework, FASB's staff is looking primarily at potential differences in the disclosure needs of financial statement users of public and private companies. If you accept the premise that the investors in a private company have ready access to management, said Seedman, maybe they don't need as much disclosure. The staff is also considering the unique needs of preparers of private company financials and is mulling cost-benefit analyses in that context. Also speaking at the conference was James Croker, Chief Accountant of the Securities and Exchange Commission, and he's quoted saying, a number of areas of additional research, study, and outreach, primarily and particularly to investors, would be warranted prior to implementing any significant structural change for reporting for private companies, he said. Well, with that piece of news focused on privately held companies, I would like to introduce our guest today. Brett Lockwood is joining us as an attorney from Smith, Gambrell & Russell, an attorney's firm. Brett Lockwood is a partner in the corporate practice of Smith, Gambrell & Russell, LLP, and he chairs the firm's technology law practice group. Brett devotes a substantial portion of his practice to acting as principal outside counsel with his clients, advising on corporate and technology issues and significant transaction matters. His practice areas include corporate governance, commercial and venture finance, mergers and acquisitions, corporate technology transactions, licensing law, outsourcing, strategic alliances, distribution arrangements, and executive compensation, as well as general business law matters. Brett has written and published numerous articles on business and legal topics in both regional and national publications and has spoken widely on business and technology-related topics. He received his BA degree cum laude from the University of North Florida, performed graduate studies at Columbia's University School of International Affairs, and received his JD degree with distinction from Emory University School of Law. And during that time at Emory, he served as executive managing editor of the Emory Law Journal and received the Loughlin Award for Excellence in Legal Research and Writing. Well, Brett, wow, that's a long introduction. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Lorraine. How are you?
Doing very well. Thank you for being our guest today.
Absolutely.
Well, Brett, let's start at the beginning. You've got quite a distinguished career. What was your first job? Was there a job that you held prior to getting into the legal practice? And if so, what was it?
Well, you know, I've been working for a long time. In fact, I've done a number of different things. But probably my first job was when I was a kid. Age 12, I worked in a convenience store for about 10 hours a week, and I've really been working ever since. But immediately prior to becoming a lawyer, I actually worked at the bank as an internal auditor, and I did that for several years and finally pursued the lawyer thing. But being an auditor was actually a terrific experience for becoming a lawyer, because I'm not sure whether people despise lawyers or auditors more, so it did help me develop a pretty thick skin.
That's too funny. Well, from there, from that auditing background, what was the jump that you made, and why did you make that jump? That's quite a significant jump from accounting and finance into legal.
Sure. Well, you know, it's I was really at a career crossroads in terms of whether I was going to be a business person and really wanted to be a banker at that particular point in my life, and perhaps even to run my own bank someday, versus pursuing the law, which had always been an interest of mine. And I was always one of those kids growing up that would be the devil's advocate. So relatives and others said this guy should be a lawyer. But what's interesting is my approach in doing business transactions is very much not to be argumentative. In fact, to be as they say, a deal maker rather than a deal breaker. And that's a difficult thing at times when you're inclined to be skeptical and a devil's advocate. But those smoothing of the edges come over time.
Now, does it help you that you had that basis in finance and accounting?
Yeah, in some sense, transactional lawyers certainly need to have good transactional lawyers should have a good sense of business and should be very practical-minded. Doing probably about half of my practice deals with commercializing technology. The other half deals with finance and acquisition issues. And finances and accounting-related issues come up across the board in all of those categories of business activity. But particularly with respect to finance matters and acquisition matters, so it's probably not essential, but it's probably a nice plus factor that's part of my practice.
Sure, and I would imagine it gives you a breadth of understanding that perhaps some of your counterparts may not necessarily naturally come to them.
Well, yeah, it at least allows another avenue of communication with clients, business people. And I think that's communication is a big part of doing well with others in so many different ways. You have to be able to speak their language, communicate to them in a way that is meaningful.
Sure. Well, let's, if we can, take a couple of minutes to talk about the aspects of the commercial trade that you manage in your practice. You've talked about two separate components. Maybe give us an overview of the sorts of transactions that you help with and the maybe the activities surrounding those.
Sure. Well, you know, probably starting at the broadest and coming down to the narrow, you know, in many ways, I suppose this comes with experience and time, you know, time in the vineyard and that experience which people and clients desire to tap into. So many days, it's perhaps less about specific transactions and about helping a company manage their business and acting as a high-level counselor, a sounding board, a check on market or deal terms. Essentially to be a high-level advisor, but coming down more narrowly, as I mentioned earlier, about half of what I do deals with commercializing technology and helping user companies which are virtually every company in the business world, deal with technology issues. And the other half of my practice deals with finance and acquisition matters. And there's some overlap between those three big buckets of activity, but probably the most significant piece of what I do day in and day out, week in, week out, deals with technology transactions. And on the technology transaction side, that deals with commercializing technology. There are quite a few subsets under that, and deals with certainly protecting technology from the basic intellectual property rights that go along with that, patents, copyrights, trademarks, et cetera, to licensing transactions, development transactions, implementation of IT systems, and it really there's really quite a broad gamut. But if it involves somehow technology in the business environment, there's usually a contract along the way somewhere, and that contract needs to be vetted from the business standpoint, not only in terms of are the business terms that have been negotiated, usually the economic terms, are they reflected in whatever the agreement are, but are the risks to the business managed appropriately, or at least in keeping with the expectations of the organization.
Now, you've used a term that for accountant types such as myself get all a little bit hot under the collar about when you talked about technology and licensing fees, intellectual property. That is an area of the balance sheet that has a softness to us, and valuation tends to be very challenging. And it can be one where a company is acquired or merged or some kind of a joint venture. When you're looking at the valuation of the corporate assets, it's a very awkward area to value, because essentially whatever a business party is willing to pay is ultimately the value. Tell us, if you can, let's step a little bit back from there, because you're the advisor that is helping companies determine the types of assets that they have in terms of that technology and how to protect them. Are there particular aspects that us finance folks should perhaps take away? Are there particular protection elements that we need to consider?
Okay, sure. So what's interesting is that most companies, regardless of what sector you're in, so whether you're a technology company or a non-technology company, probably have some valuable technology assets, and they tend to, I think many companies tend to think of those in terms of what we refer to generally as intellectual property assets, because most technology has some sort of intellectual property rights associated with it. And as I mentioned, the principal categories are patented technology, copyright, trade secrets, and trademarks. And my sense is that the business community is fairly sophisticated generally about protecting intellectual property, I think, for various reasons, because technology is so much a part of so many businesses of all different types. Companies are aware that they need to protect their intellectual property rights. And, you know, some companies are even savvy to the point, even if it's not their core business, and from the CFO's perspective in particular, you know, is there something on the balance sheet? Is there something in our coffers that is an underutilized intellectual property or technology asset that we might be able to commercialize? Perhaps a business that has a software application that is really nifty, gives it some sort of advantage, and you know, perhaps that same tool or application or piece of technology, whatever it happens to be, might be something that could be commercialized as an additional revenue stream. And so companies are getting much more sophisticated about protecting their IP, but also about, you know, is there something within our under the hood, among our assets that are underutilized, that could be an additional revenue stream.
And that could be something, as you say, that is not core business. For example,
right,
in the field in which my company is, in the elements of consulting, it could be a process or a means to systematically or procedurally assist a company go through certain challenges. It could be, for example, some aspect of a brand marketing that perhaps they haven't yet considered to trademark, or it could be some intellectual property that potentially could be white papered and therefore maybe copyrighted.
Yeah, absolutely. What's interesting is that for the longest time, patents were sort of the gold standard in many ways for protecting technology applications, and so much so that software patents and it sort of morphed into protection around what are called process patents. But it's become much more difficult because so many companies have in innovative, creative ways sought to patent and exclude others as a result of practicing things that are very basic, fundamental processes. And so the standard for what can be patented has, in the past several years, become much higher, and there actually needs to be, with respect to a process, there actually needs to be a machine that interface, if you will, or a device interface, which somewhat is consistent with what the common sense general public would think of as in the realm of patent. But it is one of those areas that we bump up against all the time. Hey, we've got this nifty process, can we patent it? But companies have intellectual property, all about them, and I think it's always good to kick the tires and ask, is there anything else here that we can take good advantage of?
And that's the point at which you're really having a business conversation with your client.
Right. Absolutely.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the aspects specifically of technology companies. And from the outside looking in, one might think of technology companies in maybe one of a couple of different ways. Certainly there are the hardware technology companies that produce the, the cell phones, the gadgets, the electrical equipment, the DVDs and the refrigerators and so forth. Anything that has technology running it, let's face it, a car today has a significant amount of technology. And then there are technology companies that essentially have some kind of a software or a license-based product. And there may be more. I may be generalizing or overgeneralizing, but let's talk a little bit about the aspects of your business as it relates to the technology companies and how the financial aspects of that perhaps need to be considered.
Sure. So as I mentioned, I work with both technology companies, and by that, what is a technology company? It's a company whose business, and particularly its the way in which it generates revenue is driven by a technology product of whatever sort, including, many of the kinds of products that you just ticked through. But I think those companies have many core business issues that are of the same kind and not significantly different. Usually it's a matter of degree as opposed to a difference of kind than a non-technology product-driven business. But, in my practice, I frequently think of technology more functionally and less in terms of whether a business is a technology business. And because if you're a user of technology, some sort of technology service or product, you've got what we think of as technology legal and technology risk issues all over the place. And you need to manage those issues.
So, for example, a company that develops social media platforms or marketing platforms through the internet, web-based sources, a web design company, would they be a technology company under that realm?
It could very well be. The way in which businesses are interacting these days, so much more is being pushed online. Boundaries between the way in which products and services are delivered in the, compared to the traditional old line, offline world are blurring. Businesses that a manufacturing company may have a significant distribution channel through online means. Because they have a significant online component to their business, does that make them a technology company? It's the lines are actually quite blurred, and you know, that's true with so many different businesses, not only in terms of how services are delivered or products are delivered to end user customers, but also in terms of how the products are produced, how employees or personnel or staff, telecommuting issues permeate all manner of different businesses. So the lines are fairly blurry, which is why I tend to think of, while there are certain companies that one would clearly think of as technology companies, say a software company or something, a business that is purely an online business, the issues that I wrestle with tend to be ones that that a business would have in many cases, whether they think of themselves as a technology or non-technology company. So, and the risks that go along with those things that potentially impact impact the CFO.
Sure. So let's maybe dig into one or two of those challenges. Are there challenges that perhaps the company, in general terms, tends not to recognize? Are there some things that scream out to you?
Well, you know, an area of a challenge, if you will, and I think of it in terms of an area of risk that probably is starting to get a great deal more attention, but it's an issue that really affects many, many different kinds of businesses, which is, broadly speaking, data security issues. And data security is multifaceted. If you're a consumer-focused business, it also has a data privacy element in terms of customer or user relations, and how does that impact the bottom line. In the news, it seems every week, if not every day, significant security breaches are reported. Just yesterday, Citigroup reported that there was an exposure of somewhere on the order of several hundred thousand user accounts, and the data goes along with that. And you know, that's both a significant reputational as well as a cost issue. It has to do with the fact that so much of, you know, financial institutions certainly, but have so much of their gather so much data, and so much of it is available through computing systems. But that's true of a manufacturing business as well. So many businesses store data in ways that are remotely accessible, and in systems that can be accessed remotely, because we're all interconnected. And so I'd say, you know, I won't call it a sleeper issue, but I think it's an issue that's getting a lot more attention, or data security and data privacy issues. And it affects virtually every kind of business.
And I'm going to interject a term, and perhaps you can give us a brief description of the term, but is this true particularly as the world tends to now move into an area of cloud computing, where your data may be stored by somebody else in an outsource relationship?
Right. So, you know, so cloud computing is one of those interesting technology areas, like so many, that is both a blessing and a curse. The blessing, you know, maybe just define what cloud computing is, because it's almost a buzzword at this point, although it's been percolating below the business mainstream for a few years. But cloud computing, I'd say probably the simplest way to explain it is to use an analogy to electricity. It's, think of it as utility computing, where, as with electricity, you use what you need, when you need it, and you pay as you go, and you don't have all of the cost associated with building out an infrastructure to support delivery and use of that utility. So you don't have significant equipment costs, you don't have significant licensing costs, and, you know, from a CFO's perspective, it's actually generally considered to be a very positive thing, because from the economic perspective, you know, it's significantly less upfront cost, ongoing cost. You treat those costs as operating expenditures. It gives you some interesting tax benefits, and not as capital expenditures. So there's a lot of wonderful things about cloud computing in what we think of as a utility computing model. But the flip side and the curse side are the various risks that come along with, as you mentioned, data being stored by others. You don't have on-site control of data. You've got a greater dependence on the service provider, who you may not know as much as you ought to know about. You may not have done sufficient diligence. You certainly don't know as much about them as you do your own organization. So you've got a significant service continuity or outage risk, and outages occur for many different reasons, not merely security breaches from hackers, such as what happened at Citigroup and some of the other notable data breach stories that we hear about. You also have some peculiar legal issues around if this data is flowing around out there on remote servers, is it crossing country borders, or in such a way that it implicates jurisdictional issues across country lines? And if you have to fight to get the data back, you know, are you now against your will, so to speak, now dealing with, let's say, data that's in Europe that you thought should have been here in the state side if you're a U.S. company? So you've got a lot of, there are a lot of peculiar issues that come, peculiar risk issues, but they all boil down to fundamentally or principally to data security issues. And, you know, the business community, the legal community are wrestling with these issues. It's a great example where technology and business activity, or drives business activity, and the appropriate legal rules and risk management rules, including insurance, insurance products, and the legal rules have not really caught up with ways to help the business community manage these risks in a routinized way. And eventually that will come, but we're still at the early stages of trying to figure out how to manage all those risks. And certainly contractually you deal with that as best you can, but it's a challenging area for CFOs, and it's tempting, and you know, it is one that many companies will undoubtedly dip their toes into and see if they can stomach whatever risk is there, and I think they'll find that there's a lot of good there. So it's not going to go away, and it's just going to increase. We'll all have to figure out the challenges together and the blessings together.
So something that you mentioned there, Brett, I'd like to maybe expand upon. You talked about an aspect of insurance. Should CFOs now be looking to insure against these kind of hacking risks?
You know, what's interesting is that if that insurance is available, yes. There really aren't as many insurance products out there to insure against online associated liabilities as I believe there ought to be. And the varieties of products have too many exclusions, as is typical when you read the insurance fine print. So, and that market will come along. That's partly a function of the fact that insurance companies can underwrite risk to the extent they understand the risks. And because business experience is probably not as significant as it needs to be with cloud computing, insurance companies are scratching their heads, how do we manage this risk in a way that we can actually insure it? But, you know, I think certainly insurance is a key component that companies that we work with certainly explore, both, again, as users or as providers of technology. But I'll use the term loosely, other kinds of insurance, not an insurance product, that companies need to consider are contractual provisions, which provide an ounce of prevention of a sort, which provide some assurance against risk. You know, certain contractual standards around service levels, covenants around and undertakings around physical and system security, data backup, disaster recovery. These are the kinds of things that a company and CFOs tend to be involved in this as much as the IT functions, because IT functions in many organizations report up through the CFO, need to be focused on. There's also, since you kicked the program off with referencing the AICPA, I thought it's particularly appropriate that I mention that effective June 15th of this year, there is a new audit standard called SSAE-16, which brings with it several new security-related reports, and they're referred to as SOC 1, SOC 2, and SOC 3 reports, which replaces a current auditing standard called SAS 70, which those that deal with technology and technology service providers will be well familiar with. But SAS 70 has always been a square peg in a round hole, and the AICPA has long recognized this, and they are trying to create more auditing standards against security, confidentiality, processing integrity standards that the business community can rely upon. And, you know, certainly cloud computing, which brings a whole host of risk issues around data, it's a happy coincidence that this new standard is coming into effect just as cloud computing is becoming, I believe, part of the business mainstream.
And interestingly enough, the accounting standard setters are keeping in tune with a very key component of certainly the legal community and the finance community put their heads together every quarter to determine what contingencies are out there, and it helps us determine what level of reserves we need to have. Certainly going from conference to conference and speaking with experts, I hear securities experts say it's not a matter of if you are hacked, it's more a matter of when your company is going to be hacked. And I was at a conference this week with the National Association of Corporate Directors, where there were several of the board of directors for whom their number one concern or one of their top three concerns was the risk from being hacked.
Right.
And they didn't know how to prevent it necessarily. They didn't have the expertise at the board level to understand it.
Mm-hmm.
But their technology folks were saying, yep, it's going to happen.
Yep. Yeah, I completely agree. And, you know, what's interesting is that hacking risk or risk of intrusion from an outsider is certainly out there, and it's what people tend to think about with respect to data breaches. But probably as importantly, so I don't want to contradict the experts that you just cited, because I think hacking or outside intrusion risk is a big issue. But within the data security realm, what is probably as significant is just operator error, human error, innocent error, inadvertence, exposing data inadvertently, because IT folks or others that have control or access to data in the business environment, the actual user environment, aren't following proper procedures or controls. And they, in many ways, are the weakest link in that security chain. And so it starts sometimes with just user organizations making sure that they're following adequate controls so that they themselves don't expose their data inadvertently and then set into motion all of the requirements around data breaches and the costs that go along with that. So,
interestingly enough, I was at this conference yesterday. Aon was talking about helping their clients, and one of the aspects of what was discussed was exactly this and the risk around it and how you insure for it.
Mm-hmm.
But I was at a technology conference about a month or so ago with some of the founders of ISS, Internet Security Systems, and they said that when they go into large corporations, it's frightening the number of individual employees whose password is PASSWORD, or the company name, or their own name,
right.
Or they've never changed it from whatever it was originally set up as.
Right.
And, you
right.
know, a laptop left, you know, the hackers tend to be pretty much more intelligent than the average employee.
Right. Yeah, so I couldn't agree more. So there's a lot of room for improvement there. You know, and from the CFO's perspective, you know, these things translate into risks and ultimately perhaps cost if those risks aren't managed well.
Sure. Well, in wrapping up, we have a tradition on the show to ask our CFO guests a CFO tip of the month. It's a little bit different. You're coming from a transactional and a technology side of the house, but I would like to ask you from the perspective of the legal business that you manage for your clients in commerce, what is your CFO tip of the month?
Sure. Well, probably I'd make a couple of observations. One is just circling back briefly to what we were just talking about in terms of data security. Just for a CFO, I think they need, if they're not already aware of it, they need to be prepared to be more familiar with SOC 1, 2, and 3 reports. They're going to be useful tools that both user legal tip as much as it is a CFO tip, is just I think common sense within the law will get you most of the way there. I often tell business folks you can get by in a lot of ways without a lawyer, but for that last mile, bring in your lawyers, bring in your accountants, bring in your professional advisors to help you, you know, put the icing on the cake.
Well, that's a great tip. Thank you very much, Brett. And formally, I would like to thank you, Brett Lockwood, for being our guest today. You've been sharing some really great tips, and that's helping us in the CFO community be better at what we do. So thank you.
Thanks so much, Lorraine.
And thanks also go to our contributor, CFO.com, and to our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, providing CFOs and controllers to Fortune 1000 companies and small, fast-growing businesses alike. For more information about Delaney, go to www.delaneyllc.com. Thanks also go to Financial Executives International, the preeminent association for CFOs and financial executives. You can see their website at www.financialexecutives.org. This and other thought leadership from today's CFO is available right from your computer at cforadio.com. If you are a CFO and would like to be a guest on the show, please contact us via the web. And thank you for listening to CFO Radio. This is Lorraine Chilvers signing off until next time.